This is Eric Severide pinch hitting for Ed Murrow. First, from London, Professor Arnold Toynbee. In 100 years, he will have but one word after his name, and that will be historian. And I don't see why I should try to add any more. Professor Toynbee, do you think there'll be any civilization here 100 years from now to study the history that you've recorded?
Yes, I do. That's about the most hazardous thing anyone could say, straightforward. I think in 10 years from now, and 100 years from now, there'll be human beings existing anywhere.
Our second guest is a poet, novelist, historian, scholar who now lives in Mallorca, the distinguished Robert Graves, whose poetry is interlaced with history and extends all the way from Jesus to David Copperfield. Mr. Graves, have you ever met Professor Toynbee?
He may not remember me, but I once ran a grocery store just outside Oxford, and I used to sell...
I remember very well, yes.
Do you remember?
Yes, of course.
They were good groceries, weren't they?
From Miami, Florida, America's peripatetic pessimist, Philip Wiley, whose generation of vipers and assault on motherhood has caused him to be labeled a cynic. But his essay on morals seems to leave hope for the human race. Mr. Wiley, are we tuned in on your pessimistic or on your optimistic band?
Well, I would answer that by saying I would never either one, at least intentionally. I always tried to be a realist, but I often took the opposite side when I thought other people were being unrealistically optimistic or pessimistic.
But gentlemen, I'd like to start off with a question that has bothered me personally, and that is, why is there more crime and prostitution and other such evils in an era of great prosperity in the West than there was when we were much poorer? The old theory was that poverty brought about these things. What is the answer to that? Would you like to start, Professor Toynbee?
I think it's that hasn't changed. One thing goes all through life today is we have to move faster than is... it's hardly possible to move so fast. And I think that upsets people. The change may be for the better. You may be getting more prosperous and richer, but all the same, it's upsetting. And that sends people off the rails. That's one explanation anyway, I think.
When you say that prostitution and so on are much worse now than they ever were, I very much doubt it. Victorian England was really pretty bad, though they put a cover on it. Things went on there you wouldn't believe until you get the inside story on it.
Well, I agree about that. I think we're more honest now and more open and more really concerned to do something about it.
I have a feeling that our human sex behavior and its morality is quite a different part of human living and requires or has today a separate ethic and separate cultures from the rest of our ethics, our honesty, integrity, the ethics of the good scientist and so on. I can't see, considering the decline in what is called sex morality, as necessarily analogous to or even related to our decline in honesty, integrity, and overall ethics.
You can't really, if you're married and you're going to preserve honesty and integrity, it's extremely difficult to be faithless to your wife without impairing that integrity. I know there are some countries where adultery is an understood thing, and I dare say they've got their own way of working it out. But I'm beginning it.
Well, I didn't recommend it. Neither did I recommend prostitution. I was just thinking in an abstract way.
I wanted to ask you all right at this point a rather a wide-armed question here about religion. Is it out of date as we have known religion? Do we need a new kind of religion for this atomic age?
I think the trouble was Christianity. Is that they've frozen their dogma and are unable to unfreeze it. And that's been the trouble since the early Middle Ages. They were geared to the old Ptolemaic theory of the sun going round the earth, and it was very, very difficult for them to switch over to the Copernican system. And they had to imprison Galileo before, and all that, you know, that trouble. it was awful difficult for them to switch over to the Copernican system in which the Earth goes round the Sun. And other parts of their dogma are untreasable. While they remain untreasable, the connection between Christianity and science is precarious.
I think all dogmas, as Professor Toynbee has showed in his books, tend to close the minds of their believers. I think our ethics, insofar as they derive from religions, began as primitive man's fear of death and his attempt to evade it by creating all sorts of heavens and hells, to which man generally still subscribes in the expectation that he will live forever and that he will be rewarded or punished according to how he lived on earth. This I do not believe. I think this is probably at the root of modern tragic, materialistic, amoral behavior, because I think Joseph Wood Crooks, if you're familiar with his work, said the most interesting truth in our time, except a very few, and that is, in talking about the evolution of life, that when life was just a one-cell being, each cell divided and became two, and therefore life was biologically immortal. But when sex was invented by nature for the purpose of making almost an infinite increase in the speed of variation of living things and therefore of evolution, the price nature had to exact for the first time was death. And when we transpose that idea on man, I think it means simply this, that the golden rule should be revised to have a time factor, and that we should ideally live and therefore have our ethics based on the thought that we do as we would have ourselves do if we knew we were to be born 50 and 100 years from now, that the hope of humanity, not of selfish survival, is the ideal source of man's ethical pattern.
I think Mr. Wiley's touched the hardest problem that human beings have. We have to get out of ourselves and beyond ourselves, and we're self-centered, and yet we can't do anything we feel worthwhile unless we get beyond ourselves. May I go back to this question of religion? I agree that why religion has fallen out of tune with modern man is that it's got frozen hard, anyway, Christianity in the West. I think when anything's institutionalized, the people who run institutions are under a tremendous temptation to freeze things. They have a terrible fear that change will upset their institutions. Actually, if they oppose change too much, that busts up their institutions as an explosion. I believe that underneath, religion is the same in the depths and should be always varying and changing on the surface.
Religion has been frozen, first of all in among the Jews and then taken over by the Christians in a sort of social ambience, if that's the right word, which bears no relation to the present. That the God there is conceived as an Oriental monarch with a son who's a sort of vizier and a lot of angels around, and woman doesn't come into it. Just recently the Virgin has been allowed a dogmatic assumption, which is one step up, but the relation of the sexes is not represented at all. The real relation of the sexes is not represented in the Christian religion, and I think that's no women are allowed to speak in church according to St. Paul, and that's been followed, and religion doesn't make social sense now.
Mr. Graves, you have written very graphically about the past particularly about the Roman Empire, one of your novels, at one of its more corrupt and declining periods. Do you see any similarities in Western societies today from that period of Rome?
Well, the Romans were awful people, you know. They had no taste or sense or originality. They simply roped in all that they could get from the Etruscans first and then from the Greeks, and they exploited it ruthlessly. And I don't think that the same thing is happening now, because I think America, who's now the landlord, has more taste than the Romans had and is more really interested in what I call spiritual things.
And more generosity, too.
Yes. My goodness, yes.
I think this, too, about Americans. Although they are materialistic, although they do not have the ideals that I think that they might, and all people might, that they're generous in a way that is without precedent. The United States has given more treasure and help to its enemies, I think, than any other country ever gave to its allies.
I think America's great strength in the world today is that everyone realizes that America doesn't want to domineer over other people, that her leading role has been really thrown upon her by history and not by her will. That makes people readier to accept the American lead. There have been some nations in the world, if you can think of in our time, several, which have obviously been eager to dominate other people. And that, of course, puts everyone off and makes them resist.
Mr. Graves was saying something about the tastelessness of the Roman period, and I'd ask him if there are any comparisons with our period. And Mr. Wiley has written very graphically about taste in American life some years ago, and I wonder if Mr. Wiley would like to remark on that.
A number of Americans do have good taste, but the great majority lack it entirely. But they even lack a deeper thing than taste that's related to it in their materialism today. Today, we are becoming isolationists. Our people, our government, in the main, are interested in our own prosperity. A great many Americans are unaware that losing the Cold War will be as disastrous as a exterminating H-bomb war. And we are in one of those periods of our history where more and more money and more goods for more and more people in the United States is the main goal of most people. And that, I think, is the acme of human bad taste, call it.
Gentlemen, let's interrupt the flow of history for a moment to hear from our patron and benefactor, Olin Matheson.
The world of chemicals is one of endless research and creation. And at Olin Matheson, chemists have already produced vast numbers of different compounds. Compounds for chemicals to put life into the things we enjoy today. In years to come, little girls like these may be playing hopscotch on the moon. But meanwhile, the Earth, with its glittering array of wonders from chemicals, will be their world of tomorrow. A world of shimmering glass. A world of wonders through chemicals from Olin Matheson. A world where even water, soap, are touched by the magic of chemicals. Chemicals to soften and purify the nation's water supply, to make soap and detergents for home and industry, to preserve the food they eat, to make their drinking water safe and improve their manner of living in a thousand ways. These little girls live in a world of strange-sounding names like soda ash, caustic soda, chlorine, ethylene oxide, chemicals that help make their lives healthier. When you read about new accomplishments in chemical science, you can be certain Olin Matheson had a hand in their development. Small World continues with Philip Wiley, Robert Graves, Arnold Toynbee, and Eric Severide.
A while ago, Mr. Wiley mentioned the Cold War. Isn't it possible, gentlemen, that the Cold War has done the world a lot of good as well as harm in terms of the competition to help other countries and so on? Do any of you agree with that?
I think of stalemate of nuclear weapons, which I believe we have and will have for a long time, will give the free world an opportunity to defeat the communist world in its own real terms. I think of the meaning of freedom and the meaning and the source of ethics is something like this. If we all gave up the energy and time and effort that we have dogmatically put into trying to save our own selves forever and realized that the meaning of man was the future of man, his children and those beyond, if we gave up that particular kind of selfishness and time and faced death, we might change all our values, all our ethics, all our purposes, and we might someday even persuade the Russians to make similar changes.
Does Professor Toynbee have anything good to say about the Cold War?
Well, one very good thing you can say about it is that the Cold War is not the atomic war. If we must have competition, I'd naturally rather have competition in helping the underdeveloped countries than in blowing each other to bits, and them too. But competition, even in helping the underdeveloped countries, is a pretty dangerous thing. There's politics in it. It's a form of political warfare, isn't it? I should be happier if we could get to cooperation in helping the underdeveloped countries. I don't think we need competition as a spur to us to help them, because unless the prosperous minority of the human race does get together to help the unprosperous majority, there's going to be a blow-up. Because if you have those extreme differences that still are in the world between the very rich and the very poor peoples, you will have an explosion in the end which they won't be of the atomic kind, will be just as destructive.
You speak of not trying to compete with the Soviets and Red China.
Yes.
What do we do? Always supposing that this country and others are equally aware of communist intentions, when they encroach continually on the detached or the free world, how do we not compete?
We may have some common interests, mayn't we? I think one common interest is to clear up the slums of the world. After all, Russia is now part of the rich minority of the human race. She's on our side of the line, same side of the line as us in that. Also, I should guess that China is an anxiety to Russia as well as to the rest of us. So I don't see the world divided by one very sharp and uncrossable line. I see a number of different lines, which one, of course, is the communist versus non-communist division. But I think the world is in a very fluid state. We're going to see some surprising changes of groupings, I think, especially as China comes to the fore. It's going to put Russia in quite a different situation, I think.
You think China now are the outer barbarians, to use your phrase. But have you ever thought of this? If you study the philosophy of communists, must you not consider, at least as possible, because of their indoctrination and because they believe communism, which is hard for us to believe, mustn't we consider that possibly the Soviet Chinese antagonism, even the great population menace, is a phony, synthetic, hidden endeavor of the Russian and the Red Chinese together to make us think they're going to be antagonistic? Must we not always at least consider that?
Yes, we're always guessing at the motives of other people, aren't we? It's just a guess. But if I try and put myself in the place of a Russian now, I think I should be more anxious about China than I should be about the Western countries. I should think of the historical claims that China has on what is now Russian territory, which are large. Vladivostok was once part of China. Outer Mongolia was once part of China, and so on. And I should therefore wish to play down my enmity with other parts of the world, I think.
You ought to know.
Well, I think you're all taking this too seriously. I remember a nice line by Laura Riding, which is, "Have no wide fears for us. Its universal name is deluge." Not far. I think that this atomic scare... Well, listen, the atomic scientists are all crazy. I've known a few of them. In fact, my daughter married one. And his only interest is in the very few people he can talk to. There's a Pakistani whom he can talk to, and there's a young chap in England whose name can't be mentioned because he's hush-hush, and then there are a few Russian chaps who he's very pleased to meet, and they talk in this extraordinary crazy language of their own, and they really have no sense of nationality very much, and they consider themselves to be the gods of the present universe, and they despise principalities and powers. They consider prime ministers and presidents are just nuisances.
Well, I've noticed that too. I've been sometimes where the mathematicians as well as the physicists get together. They're all lonely men, and when they meet someone who can talk their language, it's the sensation of their life. And they just get talking like brothers. As you say, it cuts across nationality, race, religion, everything else.
And Professor Toynbee, in an article this Christmas, this New Year's, was saying that organization and industrialization and urbanization was dehumanizing the human race, making us sort of subhuman caricatures of ants and bees.
I will agree with your implication now that conformity is overwhelming this country. This country today has turned even its Christianity very widely into a materialism that is comparable in aim, except that is not expansionist, to Marxism. Even ministers now are telling us that it's all right to pray for success things, and Christianity, it seems to me, will be made conformist by our very materialism that way, because what Jesus was talking about was the opposite of that. He's the man who said, sell all your goods and feed the poor and go and preach the gospel. He was interested in what was then understood of the human mind and spirit.
The sort of economy which is founded on the supply and demand and on rationalization of industry does give the human spirit a pretty poor chance. I discussed that point with this son-in-law of mine, this atomic scientist. He said, what's the good of these? There were some old drinking glasses I had, old Limerick glasses. He said, what's the good of them? It's so much more simple to have everything built in a mold. And I said, you don't understand fatigue reactions. And he said, that gave him a new idea. He said, what about fatigue reactions? And I said, well, the human eye is accustomed to man-formed curves, not to mathematic curves. The eye tires with when it's exposed to the rectangle, the exactly drawn circle, the perfect parabola. I live in an old house and built by hand, and I can only work there. As soon as I'm exposed to a functional building, and functional seems to me to mean inhumanity, my spirit perishes and I can do nothing. And unfortunately, the urbanization, which is spreading rapidly over the world, does depress the human spirit to that extent.
Well, yes, if you travel about the world, I think in the most countries that are otherwise very different from each other, you see this same thing happening everywhere, that people feel a kind of fascination for the cities, and they pour into the cities and live in shanty towns around them, even if there's nothing for them to do. They lose their old roots, they don't gain new roots. I think that is alarming.
I have the luck to be talking to two of the men on this earth who could answer it best. I'd like to ask both Mr. Graves and Professor Toynbee this. Do they think we are done for and on the way down, or do they believe, as I do, that we still have a great hope of a great future?
I don't think we're done for, no. I think the future's entirely open. It's up to us, I think. We have the choice. It's very largely in our hands. But the choice is rather extreme now. We can do more damage or do more good than our predecessors were able to do. We have more power behind anything we do, so our choices matter more.
I believe that things have got to get very much worse before they get any better. I think it's all got to end in a good cry, and then maybe we'll pick up the pieces. That's my view as a poor peasant living back in the 18th century in Spain.
Gentlemen, I'm sorry to say we have now run out of our time. Perhaps you three thinkers would like to say goodnight to one another.
Good night, Mr. Sutherland, Dr. Toynbee, Mr. Grave.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Good night. We'll tell you about next week's guests in just a minute.